Hey, guys. Happy Friday. Thanks for joining us again for the FDN Fantastic Friday call. That's our little theme we play in the beginning. I think that comes through on most recordings, so we are family. And we hadn't talked about that much lately. We'd had a change in our theme song before the show. Intro music, I guess, whatever you call that. Ryan probably knows the proper term for that. But that's what we are, a big family of caring, trained, highly trained practitioners working to help change the world on a lot of different levels, right, especially in the health realm and the far-reaching effect of that. So good to be with you guys. Good to be with family. Consider you guys a family on the call here. We're, again, working together to get better at what we do and to help support you on these Friday calls. We do an hour almost every week, and we've been doing it for a long time for you guys to call in, ask some questions, get some clarification on some things, support however you need, whatever you need. This is a live call, and you can dial in and ask a question. To do that, you want to dial 347-637-1378. Again, 347-637-1378. And if you would, just hit 1 on your keypad or your button, whatever device you're calling from there. That'll let me know that you want to come on. I'll call out your area code, make sure I've got the right person, get your name, and you can ask a question or two for me and Ryan, and we're happy to, again, help out today. So you guys don't be shy. We only have an hour, which that usually covers maybe 5 or 6 questions on a good day, so we give you some long, more in-depth answers typically. And so if you have a question, you want to jump on, do that in the very beginning of the show, and we'll do some announcements here and congratulate a few graduates before we get into questions, but don't be shy. I'm your host, Brandon Mollet, FDN mentor, clinical advisor, FDN practitioner for over 10 years now. Proud to be part of the ranks here of awesome practitioners doing our thing. And then I've got my co-host with me, Ryan Monahan. He has those titles plus a bunch of other stuff too. And you know him well. He's been helping out lots and lots with AFDNP and our support that way, medical director consulting. And so just happy to be on with you guys again. Ryan, how are you? Thanks for being with me again this week.
I'm doing super. Glad to be here. Thanks for asking.
Good. Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to be fun. We like to answer questions. One of my favorite formats always has been Q&A on any kind of subject, just a question. So we've got some written in that we'll jump on here if we don't have any hands raised. But we'll cover it again as much as we can. It doesn't matter where you're coming to us from. If you are looking at taking this course, this is just getting a feel for what we are, what we're about, what we do. Most folks I've talked to have been following FDN for a year or more before they decided to take the course. And so listening to webinars and this podcast and other outreaches that we have, it's a good way to get a feel for what we do. And, of course, if you're a trainee moving through the course, happy to answer questions there, put you in the right direction, help you with your progress or tips or anything you need to complete the course most efficiently and get the most out of the course. We're happy to comment on those things. Enjoy having those Zoom calls with you guys. If you guys aren't aware of those, we have one Zoom call at least a week, sometimes two, depending on the schedule. So I know some trainees, you guys weren't aware of that. But you can jump on a Zoom call, reads on pretty much every one of those, and then you're going to get a mixture of mentors or course manager like Don will be on there. You've got at least 2 or 3 people you could ask questions to on a nice video Zoom conference call. So take advantage of those for questions. And, of course, this call also is for you guys as well. Also, of course, you're a graduate. If you've certified through the course and you've made it through and you want some help in anything, I'm happy to help you with your cases or there's maybe a business question or some kind of sales question that we can help out with. We do that as well. So not much is off topic around here. Okay. Well, it sets everything up, I think. I'm trying to keep those announcements a little bit shorter so we have plenty of time for questions each week. I do want to say congratulations to our graduates this week. We're proud that we get to graduate somebody, at least one person, pretty much every single week out of the year, so that's at least 52 graduates, and then most of the time it's more like 3, 4, 5, or 6. So we're very proud of that, and for all these folks that do make it through this course, because it's not a weekend course. It's not just watch a few videos, answer some multiple choice questions, and you're certified. So we put you through paces and make sure you know what you're doing and that you are confident coming out of this course and, of course, excited, but that you feel very confident, and that confidence can increase excitement. So we make sure those things are in place, and we're proud of folks. It's most folks are not just sitting home listening to Reed talk 10 hours a day and getting through the course super quickly. It's taking some time. It takes months to make it through this course, and you're juggling life and maybe another job or career, and that's to be committed and acknowledged. It's not just understanding the material, absorbing it, and practicing that with your practicals. It's more than that, and so we definitely acknowledge that too. So this week we have three, and we're staying in the United States for these three this week. So first one here is Yolanda Bondarenko, I think. Yolanda, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. Didn't have the phonetic spelling here, but she's from Colorado. She's a graduate this week. And Allison Hebert.
Represent Colorado.
There you go, Colorado. Awesome.
<Yeah. laughs>
And then moving out west there, Always Spall from San Diego. So he's connected with many of the FDNs in the area there in San Diego. So you guys might recognize a neighbor there. So, guys, great job. Congratulations. Glad to have you.
Cool.
Very good. All right, Ryan, anything update-wise, AFDMP, that you want to let us know about or anything that you've got cooking?
Everything's just kind of rocking along there. No exciting or new news to report, just, you know, the usual kind of day-to-day activity going on in AFDMP with lots of good webinars and ongoing discussion and ongoing education, and always a good time there. You know, always some really good AFDMP webinars to look forward to. Just did actually last night, I did a detective hour, which is a lot of fun. Always enjoy those over in AFDMP. We get to take a look at a more complex case where we maybe look at a client that's run four or five labs that's dealing with a complex health issue that's looking to tweak or hone in on their dress protocol. And so we kind of take a look at all of that and, you know, try to optimize that program for them, maybe even identify some healing opportunities or some connections or correlations between the tests that maybe the FDN hadn't recognized. So that's always fun. It's always I try to make it really participatory and include everyone and ask lots of questions. And those happen twice a month. And I do one once a month, and the other one is conducted by one of our other fantastic clinical mentors, Whitney Morgan. So you get to take part in that a couple times a month. And, you know, other than that, no special news to report. I know I'd mentioned this the past couple times that within the next month or so, AFDNP members are going to be offered a $10 discount per lab ordered through the medical director program. So that discount will apply to the MDP fee. So if you're running a bunch of labs all year anyways, that can basically bring you to a break-even point with the AFDNP membership and will make it kind of a no-brainer investment. That's probably all I've got, you know. Sometimes so much happens during the week, I have a tough time remembering everything that happened. Which is a good problem to have, but it's always I probably spend at least a minimum of an hour in that group a day, either just kind of like reading through some threads or responding directly to things, if not sometimes 2 or 3 hours a day if I have the time. So I really do try to answer everyone's questions. It's a really tough task for one person to take on, but I do try my best to answer every question.
Well, we don't have to have big flashy announcements every single time. I think just the consistency,
right.
You know, that's the best thing. That's what we want. Like when you have a question, when you're stuck, when you need some support or encouragement, that we're there for you. So it doesn't have to be some new kind of program we're coming by with every single week. It can just be, hey, I typed a question in there and I got some great responses. It kept me moving forward, helped that case moving forward. That's as important as anything else. I think if we just went from big announcement, a big announcement. I think that's not really the way to work. Consistency is the key with a lot of things. So thanks for being part of that consistency, Ryan.
And that's a great point. And I would say the vast majority of those that are participating in that AFENP group, those are the ones that are consistent in their practice, and they're growing their business, and they're regularly working with clients. They are continually sharpening their clinical skills, looking to, you know, broaden their knowledge, whether it be taking one of the advanced FEN courses, which we talked about this too before, but that really helped me take my skills to a whole nother level. Right? If the FEN course is like your bachelor's degree, then taking a handful of those AFENP courses is like you're getting your master's, right? There's also the possibility of passing out to be a FEN level 2 by taking a certain number of required advanced courses. I don't know the exact number there. I believe there's 8 or 10 or so in total. And if you take all of those courses, you can actually test out or pass to be a FEN level 2. So I know some people are working on that. Very valuable investment in your knowledge, in your future, in your clinical skills. And I've taken, I think, 6 or 7 of them, not all at once, like just over the years. And has really just made me sharper in interpreting HTMA testing, Dutch testing, organic acid testing. So, you know, once you've got those foundations really solidly in place, you know, those are additional places you can consider going with your practice.
Indeed, and I'll say all those, they're very practical, right? So, yeah, there's lots of education and some of the science behind there, which you need some of that, but just in true FDN fashion, it's practical. So what can you learn? What can you, first of all, be able to communicate it really simply and effectively to your client to understand, help them understand their body, maybe a complex concept or system in the body. Then also, okay, what do I do about it? Great, okay, there's all these research papers, all this stuff, and all these things, like, okay, but when it comes down to it, when I'm going to make recommendations to that person, what can I do practically, effectively? And those trainings that's a big part of those trainings, and so that's why I always endorse those, because it's not just an exercise and just education, it's the practical side. So do check those out. We've got so many good ones now. It's hard to pick a favorite for sure, but maybe functional blood chemistry is something I use often. Not that I run tons and tons of blood work, but you have clients that come to you with some blood work or some workup from their doctor, or that's the reason maybe they're coming for you. They have some blood scores that aren't great. It'd be nice if you could take a look at those and be able to pull some themes from that. Of course, not diagnosing anything, but just pulling some themes, seeing some things that might be pointing toward other things that you need to investigate using FDN methodology. I think it's very good to have a decent basic understanding of blood chemistry.
Yep, totally agree. That was definitely one of my favorites, and that's something that I use on just about every client. I'll have them, you know, run some blood chemistry, you know, through their doctor, maybe get it covered on insurance if they can to save some cost. And, you know, that can provide some really unique clues or healing opportunities, especially when you, not so much all on its own. I don't find blood chemistry to be all that terribly useful on its own, with some exceptions. But when you combine it, right, that's where it really amplifies its usefulness or healing opportunity power, right, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, running it alongside the GI map and an HTMA and an OAT test or, you know, some of those other tests. It's really where things start to become more high resolution, in my opinion, is when you have more data to work with and you start to cross-reference these clues across the different labs, right, and seeing how they're connected to each other. And that's what can really tell us a story about a person.
Yeah, good. I like that. That's how I tried to weave a nice narrative for people, even the order that I cover the results, how I go through them, kind of the pace or what things I bring up. You need to be an effective communicator, and whatever weaves a nice story, there's lots of connecting points. That's key. So we want to be good educators too, not just good coaches, but good educators. And with our FDN Advanced courses, the good thing about those that I really like is that everything's through an FDN lens. So it's not some other person with a different methodology teaching you these things. You're getting to see it through an FDN lens. And we talk about how it connects to these other labs. So you don't have to do that thinking. We help you with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I have some written in questions here, Ryan, but I will just make a call out here with all these folks that are lined up listening live, which is great to see. I can feel you guys out there. If you want to hit one on your keypad and jump on with the question, we are ready for you. If you have a question, again, hit one on the keypad. I'll call out your area code and get your name, and you probably have time for a question or two, and we're happy to help out. Otherwise, I'm going to come onto the list here. We had a few written in specifically for the call, so I'm going to grab one of these here, and I don't know if I know the answer to this one. Let me find it here again.
We can try. We can always try.
Yes. Oh, here it is. Okay. So this is one that I don't know. This has been something that was on my radar years ago. It doesn't seem like it gets as much press now. But the question is, a person's asking about nitrates. Is there a test for nitrates? How important is testing for nitrates as it pertains to gut health? How do you reconcile nitrate-rich foods with someone's metabolic type? A different kind of question here, maybe today. And you've been, I know, doing some studying on just animal products and just that whole, the paleo side, the primitive side of things. Years ago, it seemed like that nitrates in food and nitrates had a lot of press, and that if, hey, if you ate high nitrate foods or things that had preserved with nitrates or nitrites, that it was going to cause stomach cancer. That it was the worst thing in the world to eat animal products, especially ones that were preserved in some way. Is that still our understanding? It seems like that's not been so much of a thing anymore. Maybe that's where this person's going here, is that, hey, these kind of, you know, nitrates are supposed to be something really terrible, right? So how does this affect maybe metabolic type, or you're eating maybe more animal products?
So, Brandon, you know, I'm a huge nerd, so I actually just Googled it while you were asking the question, and I found whoever asked this question, I'd be happy to send this to them. This was published in a journal, it was the Journal of Aging and Disease in 2018, and this is saying here that the primary source of dietary nitrate is actually mainly green leafy vegetables, partially absorbed into blood through intestinal mucosa. And then that nitrate, this is where things get kind of nuanced. The nitrate is saying it gets converted into nitrite, right? So nitrate is NO3 and nitrite is NO2. And that conversion happens through commensal bacteria, both in the oral cavity and in the stomach, right? So that's converted into nitric oxide. Which is NO, right? So then it gets reduced into NO, right? So it starts as nitrate, then nitrite, and then nitric oxide, right? So it seems like it's more complex, right, this whole nitrate conversation, because there's a difference between nitrate, nitrite, and nitric oxide. And then it goes on to say that in the past, nitrate and nitrite were thought to be carcinogenic due to the potential formation of nitrogen compounds, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it seems like there's more than meets the eye here. I'm definitely not an expert on it. I'm just kind of reading this aloud as I go. Then it concludes and says exogenous dietary nitrate, again, I presume primarily through leafy greens, plays an important role in various physiological activities as an effective supplement to nitrite and nitric oxide in the body. What I do know through reading Dr. Ben Lynch's book, Dirty Genes, he's got a whole chapter on nitric oxide because there are certain genetic mutations that can reduce your body's natural production of nitric oxide. And from what I understand, this is just mostly from memory, that nitric oxide is really important for circulation and cardiovascular health. So there's actually a danger in not having enough nitrate or nitric oxide in your diet. Beyond that, that's all I really remember offhand. But for whoever is interested, I'd be happy to send along this article on nitrate and nitrite and its role in health and disease. I would say, more generally, this is just definitely more of a general comment, and not to deflect the question or anything like that. But, I'll see some like really specific questions like this too. Like recently saw one in the group about whether you should run a histamine test versus a GI map. And my answer to that was that, that if there was high histamine buildup and you had a client that was presenting with, with high histamine, you'll see allergic type symptoms, allergies, asthma, hives, those sorts of things could be common, headaches. Those all come to mind as high histamine symptoms. But what I would say to that is the high histamine is not the problem. It's the result of the problem. So if you're running a histamine test, yes, certainly things you can do to reduce histamine through doing a low histamine diet, increasing your intake of vitamin C, certain probiotics that can reduce histamine, et cetera, but that's really kind of treating a symptom and not really diving deep enough into addressing the potential root causes, whether it be gut dysfunction, dysbiosis, intestinal permeability, food sensitivities. All of those can contribute to excess histamine, and bacterial overgrowth, for example, can be a big contributor, like a really big one. So, basically, I was doing my best there to reframe the focus there and looking at the big picture. And sometimes it's tempting to get caught up in, single biomarkers or metabolic byproducts like histamine or ammonia or hydrogen sulfide. Whereas, in my opinion, all of that can be useful and good to, have some knowledge of, but where you're going to get the most bang for your buck is following the FDN process and running those core labs, implementing a DRESS protocol, and not worrying so much about those kinds of hyper-specific details, because the vast majority of the time, those issues will clear up as a result of your efforts, right? So that's just kind of like a more general comment. Yeah, I guess that's probably all I have to say about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think kind of on the same lines I was thinking too here. It's just our tendency to want to, people, I think, and just kind of in general, is to, one, try to vilify a certain food or try to think too reductionistic. Like, all the articles that come out about how red meat causes cancer, right? I hate to even say that phrase right there. It's just kind of crazy. So eating red meat, one particular factor is what led to a person's cancer, the whole relationship there between, is it really truly the case there, or is there many, many more factors involved in where that person ended up with their health versus one particular thing? So if I ate uncured bacon my whole life versus bacon that's cured in sodium nitrate or nitrite, is that, for me, always going to lead to something really terrible? Or could my body process it and handle that just fine because all the other things are in place that need to be? It's kind of that thing like, how perfect does your life have to be to actually achieve health? We can kind of go crazy, really, trying nothing's going to be perfect in this world. You can't do everything extremely exactly perfect every single time, avoid every toxin, avoid every heavy metal, avoid every single possible thing there could be. You just kind of drive yourself crazy with that. So I think it's finding a balance here too. And like you're saying, Brian, it's like it's everything collectively together may make that nitrate situation not even a consideration or have an effect on your
body. An issue, yeah.
An issue,
I love that, Brandon. I love that you just said that. It's such a good point. I was actually just over the past few weeks, I've been watching some training on the biome effects test. And one thing that I love that Kiran Krishnan, he's sort of the head microbiologist at Microbiome Labs. And, you know, what one thing that he really emphasizes about that biome effects test and more generally about gut health is that it's not about the individual strains. It's about the ecology, right? So kind of like really a, sort of a different point there, but related to what you're saying. It's looking at that bigger picture. You know, and he goes on at various points to say that, you know, even a certain pathogen in your gut may not be a problem if the rest of your gut is stable, right? If you have a resilient microbiome as a whole, it may prevent that certain pathogen from causing or resulting in any kind of dysfunction or disease, right? So he really emphasizes this broader approach of encouraging microbial diversity and resilience rather than, you know, going after and killing a very specific bug, right? Which, you know, sometimes we need to do that in order to restore, you know, immune function. But at the same time, we also inherently within the dress protocols built in that we're always, you know, with diet, rest, exercise, and stress reduction, those are your best tools to encourage a healthy gut environment. I totally agree. You know, you see these studies all the time correlating red meat with cancer, it seems like everything in the world is associated with cancer if you go deep
at some point
down the rabbit hole. Right.
Yeah,
at some point.
It is.
it's so reductionist because what that fails to do is look at the total health of that person. Right? You can't isolate a single variable and say that, yeah, red meat causes cancer. Red meat might be correlated or connected with cancer if you're looking at it through a narrow lens. But if you step back and say, well, is this person exercising? Are they also eating a bun with their burger? Do they drink alcohol? Do they get poor sleep? Are they living a sedentary lifestyle? You know, there's yet to be a study done linking meat to cancer where they've looked at all, the total sum of a person's health habits. And that, you know, that would be very difficult to do. But, you know, for that reason, we really, really have to take those kinds of super reductionistic approaches with a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. I think that's, we need to have an answer for that because there's going to be articles and things like that coming out from here to eternity, I'm sure. So if your client does come to you with a concern, I think you need to have some kind of answer like Rick Ryan and I are giving here. So they do have the confidence there and helping them find that perspective also. I think we have to, as practitioners, have to watch out for that. But then our clients, even more so, they're looking to us for some answers like that. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why, you know, FDN is not a, we're not a one-trick pony. It's not just one lab or one thing that we focus on. We don't just focus on hormones and expect that to fix everything. Because there's so many factors that come together to make a person healthy or sick. So, therefore, you have to address many, many factors. And it's hard to do studies like that. You're right. I guess we're the closest thing there is our case studies done by FDN.
Right.
You see those all the time with Detective Hours and your guys' success out there. So,
Or even looking at, you know, I think that one of the closest thing, in my opinion, one of the best ways we have to look at that is studying ancestral cultures, even existing ancestral cultures. And just like, you know, Weston Price did back in the 40s, and he had observed that these indigenous cultures that were, you know, maybe considered primitive to industrialized countries, but at the same time, they had no instances of Western industrialized disease like we do. Like they're just virtually non-existent in those areas of the world, or like the blue zone areas where you don't see heart disease, cancer, autoimmune conditions, depression, anxiety. You just don't see any of that, right? And what's common across those cultures is that they're getting continuous movement. They're eating real food, right? They're often eating meals together communally, right? So there's a community aspect. They're out in the sun more, right? They're growing their own food, et cetera, et cetera. But I like to use those as examples too of kind of comparing those cultures, which are radically different from, you know, most of the diet and lifestyle habits of modern industrialized cultures.
Good stuff. So that's a good question there. We don't mean to be mean about that question, but just kind of redirect a little bit. We can go down a lot of rabbit holes and chase a lot of little things that come up that may not mean that much in the grand scheme of things. So keep those questions coming. All right.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 30 minutes left in the call. So now's the time for you live guys to reach out and hit one on the keypad and ask a question. So number to call in to do that, 347-637-1378. And again, one on the keypad. Do not be shy. Love to hear from you guys. We like live callers. They're super fun. All right. I'm just checking the switchboard there. Okay, nobody as of yet. That's all right. You can be quiet on a Friday sometimes. Let's see here. Grab this other one here. I was trying to keep them the same theme here, but I don't think we have that going on yet. Okay, so this person says, I'm planning on doing my stress and hormone panel tomorrow, and I've checked the Facebook page and read instructions online in the booklet. A few questions. Some of the info differs. I take desiccated thyroid hormone first thing upon waking, and bioidentical hormone progesterone, testosterone, and estrogens. So kind of recapping here, person's going to take saliva test, access stress and hormone panel, and they take desiccated thyroid, three different hormones. Is it enough not to take these for 24 hours prior and day of the test, or should I stay off longer for more accurate results? One form says to take sample 1 hour after eating. One says two. Let's see here. Yeah, just some clarification, I think, around some of the supplements, or maybe this is prescription here, the person is taking when taking tests like this. So maybe the bigger question is trying to do the best we can to get usable information from a lab result. What things are we thinking about here? So I say just generally here, if it's a prescription, then as FTM practitioners and not the prescribing physician typically, we do not want to say come off of those, and we can't say those legally. It's something that we're going to have to factor in to the lab results. So those are going to be in that person's system. If that affects the lab results, we're going to just have to take that into account, and that does happen, right? So just as if the person, you know, got upset when they took the test for some reason, or some stress happened, or they had some caffeine and or forgot they were taking something else that affects those lab results, we're going to factor that in sometimes. And sometimes not every single marker is going to be just in its raw state. You may have outside influence. And again, we do enough markers. We look at enough different areas of the body to still be able to form an impression. That's really what we're trying to get to, is just forming this overall impression of a person. So if one out of 20 of those markers is not, you think, it's being influenced by something outside, that's just one out of 20 or two out of 20 that you don't get to have to form that impression. Is that going to make or break your impression? Probably not. So if it's a prescription, they're going to continue to take that prescription. You need to factor that into how it's affecting results. Now, if it's a supplement or something over-the-counter they're choosing to do, then yes, as much as they can tolerate it, if they can, you want to be off of those supplements. I think that's how I always like to do it, be off of those supplements for, generally, I say at least 3 days is what I prefer to do. Could be a little shorter, could be a little bit longer. I think that's fine, but I say about 3 days or so. I feel like that most things that probably have a pretty good clearance rate have cleared the system. They're not having a super direct influence, maybe some residual a little bit, but major influence, I think most things go away by that time. If you wanted to do a full week, you certainly could do that also, would be okay. That's one school of thought. Other folks would say, hey, just stay on all the things you're taking because that's what your putting into your body, and that's what you actually want to get a feel for. What you're taking, how, what effect is it having on the person's body? I can see going that direction too. I prefer to kind of pull things out and try to get more of a raw picture. But that's some general rules there, just thinking about that. Again, prescriptions, no. In this case, I don't know if this desiccated thyroid, if that's, is that a prescription? I don't know. If that's just something somebody's taking just
it probably
on
is.
Their own. Sound like it to you? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there is a product called ThyroGold, which is non-prescription, which is a bovine-derived natural thyroid glandular that you can get without a prescription. It's essentially the same thing as getting a natural desiccated prescription. The only difference is that with a prescription, it's porcine-derived from pig. Probably going to be more, you know, obviously tightly regulated too. When it's a prescription versus when it's branded as a supplement. But, you know, that's usually not really a good idea unless you, taking the, desiccated thyroid glandular, that ThyroGold, unless you're working with a practitioner and or you, like, really know what you're doing with interpreting thyroid labs, and you'd probably want to be checking that every couple months or so just to make sure you don't go in the wrong direction. But it's most likely, exactly. If you take too much ThyroGold or that natural desiccated bovine-derived thyroid glandular, you can end up making yourself inadvertently hyperthyroid, right? And then you can end up having anxiety, heart murmurs, high blood pressure, diarrhea, weight loss. Those would all be potential clues that you're hyperthyroid. So you'd also, if you were doing that on your own, you would have to know how to self-monitor your symptoms and what it would look like. But that's all kind of an aside. It's probably a 98% chance that she's referring to something like Armour or NP Thyroid, WP Thyroid, West Thyroid. These are some common prescription thyroid medications. I 100% agree with you, Brandon. I would not want anyone getting off that medication prior to running a hormone test, whether that be the Access Labs or the Dutch test, doesn't matter. In fact, I would say it's going to give you a more accurate baseline because, like, if you were to get off thyroid medication, that can slow down your adrenal glands, and you might get, like, a false low reading for the cortisol. Whereas when your thyroid is optimized at the right level, and that's stabilizing, like, your thyroid hormones and your TSH, then that's going to give you a more accurate reflection of what your adrenal glands would be doing when your thyroid is also functioning optimally, right? I've actually been I was saying this the other day in a clinical consult with looking at a hormone panel, that it really should be called, we learn about the HPA axis in the course. This is our stress management system. That's a communication system between the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the adrenal gland. But it really should be called the HPAT axis and including the thyroid gland. So actually, for example, the thyroid can stimulate the hypothalamus at the top of that chain to start that hormone cascade that eventually results in the adrenals producing cortisol. That can actually start with the thyroid signaling to the hypothalamus, which then signals the pituitary, which then signals the adrenals. Right? So it's just as much a part of that process as the HPA organs involved in the endocrine system. But it doesn't get enough love. It gets left out of that equation for some reason.
It's true. It's true. So one of my conversations when I bring a client on first time, we talk through all the, ask them about their prescriptions, about their supplementation, diet, those things, because I want to have the conversation to give them some guidance on what they need to do as far as taking their tests go. So I think really be really aware of that individual case and what the recommendations of the lab are, what you're trying to accomplish, and just do the best you can to make the situation as close to ideal to get great results that you can do something with. So it comes out of that. Mm-hmm. So it's general rules here, best practices, we'd say, but it may not be perfect every single time. I have a client on a couple prescriptions, and it made some effect on some markers I know on GI map and on a Dutch test. You know, I had to take that into account. Okay, maybe that's not that valuable of information, or at least I know, hey, that's the influence these prescriptions are having on these particular labs. And you can just do that with that information what you want to. So hopefully that helps you on mm-hmm. the lab testing side. But, yeah, know your labs, know the process. Go through that with each client and make it easy for them. That's one of the hardest things to do. You'll find with clients is, and they'll say this too, just the whole sampling process. A lot of things to keep in mind, right? They're trying to do them as quickly as they can. They're trying to not drag them out and take a full month to do four or five labs with you. They're trying to get it done. So have the conversation about logistics and timing and help them to know what to do and be available if they have a question. I hate when a person makes a mistake on a lab test and sends it in, and you get the call back from the lab saying there was a problem with it. That's very frustrating. So they take the extra time and effort and hand-holding and make sure your client is well-supported during that sampling process. And then they can go back to whatever they were doing. If they want to go back to caffeine, they want to go back to a supplement they were taking. Once you have the sample, okay, that's fine. You can go back and use those. Then when the labs come in, then we get to go to work and do our thing. So make sure you have a good high level of service when it comes to that process there,
yeah,
for people, because it can be overwhelming, you know, depending on the level of their health or brain fog or how they're feeling.
Very, very good points. Hmm. We want to give
right.
our clients the red carpet treatment. Under Indeed. Promise and over deliver, right?
100%. I love it.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, 20 minutes left in the call, so now's the time for hands to be raised. We're getting down to the wire here. And hey, I've got one. All right.
Let's do it.
That's 512 area code there. So 512, what's your name?
Can you hear me?
We can.
Yeah, sounds loud and clear.
Oh, okay. Okay. I wasn't sure if I was muted or not. this is Sherry. I'm from Austin, Texas. And I have what I like to call my practice clients, because since I'm not graduated yet. I have a client who has some severe acid reflux issues, and I was confused when I was talking to her, getting her history, because she's got a great diet, except she doesn't eat any raw food. Like, she doesn't eat any fruit at all.
She only eats cooked food? Is that what you're saying?
She only eats cooked food. She's a vegetarian. She only eats cooked food. And I had another client that was very similar to this, but she had some past medical history where she had been bombarded with antibiotics, and it was quite obvious that her gut bacteria had been destroyed by all these antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
But this client, the only really past history that she's had is she's had severe anxiety for several years. And I was wondering, can anxiety and also the lack of any raw food in the diet, can that destroy gut bacteria?
I sure think it could, for sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, I know there's, you know, the gut-brain mm-hmm. connection, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
and, vagus nerve is the largest nerve in the body, and that's like a super highway between the brain and the gut. So you can have, when you're stressed, that can send inflammatory signals down to the gut and disrupt the microbiome. If you don't mind me asking, is there a particular reason why, has she told you why she only eats cooked foods?
Well, both of these clients are from the Indian culture. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, most Indians are vegetarians. And they eat a lot of brown rice and vegetables, which you would normally think is totally healthy, but absolutely no raw food in their diet. They don't eat sugar. She doesn't eat sugar. She doesn't do sodas or fast foods or anything like that. So it's not the standard American diet. It was flabbergasting to me. I was like, wow, you know, on the surface, it looks like you have a really great diet.
Mm,
But you're
and her main complaint is... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, a severe acid reflux, like severe.
Hmm.
And,
yeah.
And obviously I suggested that, you know, obviously I can't run any lab tests on her yet. But, you know, doing a gut map or something would be very helpful. But I'm just trying to recommend some relief care to her at this point. Yeah. But
You said you can't run labs. Are you still in the course?
Yeah, I'm a trainee, yeah.
Oh, I see. Gotcha. Thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah,
you know, I would think that the first thing I would want to do is run a GI map and see exactly what's going on there. I'm sure Brandon would agree. There could be an H. pylori component there with acid reflux. It's a little counterintuitive, right? Because, H. pylori actually reduces stomach acid, but that could increase bacterial fermentation of protein, and then that could sort of put pressure back up on the esophageal sphincter, the valve between the stomach and the esophagus, and allow, you know, some of those gases and stomach acid to make its way up into the esophagus, and, you know, kind of result in that those GERD-like symptoms or acid reflux. So, you know, it's interesting. It's if you were to look it up, Chris Kresser has a really great, it's a free ebook on GERD and acid reflux. I highly recommend checking that out and giving it a read and maybe even sharing that with them. He does a really good job of explaining why low stomach acid causes acid reflux. It seems totally counterintuitive. And I kind of just went through one example like really quickly, but he goes into more details in there. So there could be a low stomach acid component being driven by H. pylori. If that weren't the case, or maybe even on top of that, you know, there could be a SIBO component to it as well. Are you familiar with that term, or have you come across SIBO?
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty highly implicated in SIBO is acid reflux. You'll see that a lot. But then you have to, you know, piece that apart. Like, we don't treat, as FDNs, we don't treat SIBO. We're always looking for what are the underlying factors that are contributing to dysfunction, you know, and H. pylori can contribute to SIBO, parasites can contribute to SIBO, thyroid dysfunction can contribute to SIBO, lots of different things. So it's one of those things where one of my favorite things to say recently is if we take acid reflux as a specific example, if you want to treat, or sorry, rather, if you want to address or, you know, improve, eradicate, however you want to say it, you want to address, if you want to address acid reflux specifically, you need to address the entire body non-specifically, right?
Right.
And you can replace acid reflux with any other symptom or condition or disease, right? If you want to address Hashimoto's specifically, you want to address the entire body non-specifically, right?
I realize that gut bacteria is probably one of the major root causes. I was just trying to the detective in me was trying to figure out, well, how did that gut bacteria get so destroyed?
You did say she was on a lot of antibiotics.
No. Another client who was on a lot of antibiotics. And interestingly enough, we've been able to reduce most of her acid reflux issues just by adding raw food to her diet and adding some fermented foods and just doing some self-care. She's reduced about 75% down.
That's fantastic. And, you know, I was going to even suggest for the client with the acid reflux, one really effective way, maybe probably one of the more effective ways to increase or improve stomach acid safely without you know, if they're also vegetarian, right? And at this point, if you can't run any tests, I would see no harm or danger in having them increase intake of fermented foods. Can be a way to increase stomach acid. Also apple cider vinegar. You can just add about, you know, a couple teaspoons or so to a glass of water, but, you know, 20 minutes before a meal or so to increase stomach acid.
Okay.
And Brandon might have a better answer to this. I'm pretty certain that either of those would be safe approaches, like fermented foods, apple cider vinegar, like if there was H. pylori in the system. What do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those are fine. I think I do a little experimentation with those too. I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other interesting thing about her diet also was that she was absolutely had very, very little healthy fats in her diet. Almost a totally fat-free diet.
I was
going to
mention,
diet.
Too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the other client, we did that. We added some raw food, did some self-care, like, you know, fermented foods and apple cider vinegar and stuff like that, and added some healthy fats. And just in actually just a couple of months, it's reduced down to 75% less.
Look at that, without even any lab data or tests. That's awesome.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, actually, I just want to share this with you briefly, too, that we know that there's no one-size-fits-all dietary approach. That can be difficult when you're working up against someone's cultural tradition. But just to mention it in case you think it's appropriate to discuss with them, some people that know my story know that I was either vegetarian or vegan for about a decade-long period. And eventually I came to the conclusion that was deteriorating or contributing to my own health deterioration. And what I learned was that when you're not eating protein for years and years and years, your stomach will stop producing acid because it doesn't need it anymore, right?
Oh.
Like you're not stimulating that acid secretion. So that can cause you to naturally decline in stomach acid over time. And that's something I experienced personally. So apologize for the dog in the background.
No, it's fine.
When I did make that transition and I eventually made the decision to start to incorporate animal protein again, you know, like many vegans who have made that transition, at first I had that sensation like the protein, like the beef or the chicken or whatever we're talking about here in terms of animal protein, it just kind of sat there. It felt like it just kind of sat in my stomach like a brick, right? And wasn't really, didn't feel like I was breaking down or digesting it very well. That's a sign of very low stomach acid, right? That also correlated on my lab work with very low alkaline phosphatase levels. Like if you look at blood chemistry, there's a marker mm-hmm. called ALP that correlates very well with as a proxy for stomach acidity. Mine was like a 30 or a 40 maybe at the time, whereas you want to see it more like between 70 and 100.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And so there was about a year-long period where I had to take like 4 to 8 capsules of HCL with each meal, with each protein-containing meal to feel like I was actually adequately breaking down protein. But in making that transition, to make a long story short, I mean, I saw radical improvements in my health, all, you know, with energy, sleep, mood, mental clarity,
right.
all kinds of stuff. So just throwing that out there that, you know, again, we know there's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all diet. In theory, a vegetarian diet could work for someone, maybe based on their genetic predisposition or metabolic type. But many might need, you know, that protein in their diet to achieve optimal function, and in especially too in regards to that issue specifically with the acid reflux, there could be an issue where over time the reduced protein reduces stomach acidity, and that can allow sort of an overproduction of dysbiotic bacteria. And that they're producing these gases that are pushing back up against the esophagus, right, and causing that reflux.
That's an interesting take on it. I never thought about that.
Yep. And I never had the reflux component, but I had lots of the other kind of telltale signs of low stomach acid. Yep. Just something to consider that, I've seen it even clinically in, I don't tend to take on a lot of vegetarian or vegan clients, but in the few that I have, I tend to see like signs of very low stomach acid, like say in their, either in their symptom questionnaire and or reflected in that very low alkaline phosphatase level. And that could trickle, by the way, down to some other clues, like you might see signs of B12 deficiency, iron deficiency, zinc deficiency. You might see all of those nutrients depleted when there's not enough stomach acid, because you really need that stomach acidity. One of the functions of having an acidic environment in the gut is to break down and assimilate certain nutrients.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, that's interesting. Well, it gives me a lot to think about in treating, just not just recommending the other things. I definitely will suggest to her that, you know, maybe that she might join the FDN Thrive program and see about getting some lab tests run.
Great idea. Yeah, great idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah, help kind of supercharge or accelerate her healing process that way.
I don't want her to have to wait until I'm done with the program, because I'm going through it pretty slowly because I want to absorb it all.
Sure.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate
it. Cool. Yeah, you got it. Thanks for calling.
Cool.
Hey, Brandon, are you still with us? I'm not sure if your audio dropped off the call, but happy to take over for a moment while you sort out any potential technical issues. So I'm not at the switchboard. I can't take any calls here or let anyone in, but looks like we only have about a minute left anyways. So this might be a good opportunity to say goodbye. And once again, congratulate all of our graduates this week. Also shout out to our Colorado graduate. Hit me up on social media or send me an email. Always love to connect locally with my FDN community. So awesome questions this week, guys. As always, it was fun. It was enlightening. Always love to, for Brandon and I to connect and share our combined knowledge to help advance and elevate our community. It's always an honor and a privilege. And yeah, till next time, guys, we'll see you next week, 1 week from now, same time as always. Don't be afraid to call. We love talking to you guys and connecting and answering your questions. But have a great weekend, and we'll see you soon.